Have you seen the Reddit? There's like that Reddit board, Am I the Asshole?
Yeah. I love that fucking one.
You can like describe your scenario. Yeah. Like, everybody's against me, but am I the asshole?
And you're like, yes, you absolutely are.
Yeah. The asshole. And sometimes it's very obvious. Those are the best ones. I saw one that was like, I'm a great sleeper, but my wife has insomnia. I like to set an alarm for every 2 hours throughout the night so I can get up and go back to sleep. Am I the asshole?
What?
Wait, what? Yeah, absolutely.
Why would you do that?
Yeah. Yeah. I have no idea.
Yeah.
So, on this episode, we're talking about hostile alien invaders with far superior technology laying siege to a world that doesn't belong to them. I'm referring, of course, to Israel. Yeah, real depressing stuff.
There was one shot that made my stomach churn when it was like a, like this kid got shot in the head and they showed it and I...
Oh, jeez. Yeah, that's tough.
I had to skip ahead after that because it was just too crazy. But
yeah, these atrocities just keep happening. It's like once every, you know, couple of years. I think the last huge one was 2014. But Israel will mount this massive depopulation, ethnic cleansing campaign in what's left of like Palestinian territory. And it's in the news for a little while, and usually the line you hear is, well, it's like it's complicated. It's really complicated. I mean, it's become sort of like shorthand for the most complicated, intractable conflict, like something unsolvable, like a Gordian knot. But
yeah,
it's really not that complicated at all. It's very clear what the power dynamics are, and there's historical precedent for what's happening, which is settler colonialism, you know, and we all know what that is because we're all living in the product of it today. But I mean, this moment, for whatever reason, has really changed the conversation more significantly than I've seen happen in the past. There's a lot more visibility and transparency on what's actually going on. I think there was a poll, and now when Americans are asked, who do you blame for the violence? Overall, 40% of Americans say Israel, 60% say Hamas. For people under 40, it's reversed. 60% blame Israel as the aggressor, 40% Hamas. Basically, the older you get, the more drastically you love Israel.
That sounds about right.
That's very interesting. So, yeah, things are changing for the better. The information's getting out. Because you're right, like, this issue has gone back so far for decades, and it's been a pretty one-sided thing the whole time. So it's cool that it's finally, like, things are evening out with the public opinion.
It's exciting.
Like a lot of things, slowly but surely, you know, as information is out there and is more transparent.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing for American opinion to be changing, you know, for the better, but I think I saw a stat in Israel, it's still overwhelmingly, you know, pro-Israel there. Like 93% of the citizens think that Israel is justified in like shoot-to-kill policies and the no-go zones and all, you know, all of the worst of the worst stuff, like wildly in favor of it still.
Yeah.
Oh, in Israel, 90% of Israeli. Well, that's not especially surprising.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, but I mean, during the Vietnam War, like, I don't know what the stats were of the people who protested that in America, but, you know, it's possible to have dissenters in your country. And in a lot of ways, that's kind of where opinion needs to change most, you know, because that's where all of the power is. And, like, they need to elect other kinds of officials. And but if they keep getting misinformed or getting the wrong idea, you know, or if they're not going to, like, come around to this kind of, what is it, a two-state solution that Palestine wants?
Well, a two-state solution is what's been advocated for generally, is what the current situation is premised upon.
Yeah.
But that's not really the case, and that's, in my opinion, not an avenue for a solution. You know, two-state solution being that Palestine governs itself, Israel governs itself, and they just sort of wall it off.
Yeah.
But for that to actually happen, Palestine would actually have to have a functional state and independent representation, control over their borders, their resources, and none of that is the case right now. What it really...
That would be a huge change, yeah.
What it really equates to now is it's an open-air prison. You know, Israel controls their borders. Exactly. They control how much electricity they're allowed to have per day. You know, it's like 4 hours of electricity per day, so they can't keep any food. They carefully control the amount of food that goes into Palestine according to calculations of the minimum necessary caloric intake before mass starvation.
Wow.
Right.
They call it keeping Palestine on a diet. So that's not two states, you know? That's...
Yeah. The casualty rate between both countries has been, like, drastically different. Like, Palestine has had, like, thousands of people die. And almost all the conflicts, like, no Israelis die. But they're sort of always portrayed as these, like, you know, victims in this case.
It's frustrating to watch.
I noticed that, too.
Israel is, like, you know, it's backed by, like, the best, you know, not the best, but the, you know, the most funded military in the world, most powerful, most technologically advanced. It has all kinds of ways of defending itself. It has the dome thing. What's that called?
The Iron Dome. Yeah. I want some Iron Dome. They're the biggest exporters, military exporters in the world per capita.
Yeah. There's a huge kind of love affair between America and Israel.
Yeah.
And one of those documentaries kind of was getting at that. Like, there's, like, lots of funding that goes on from America in Israel and from Israel in America.
Hmm.
And these kind of faux grassroots campaigns that they kind of finance to pass along their Zionist message among the youth, because they recognize that the only people who support Israel are gonna, you know, are getting older and times are changing.
Right.
And so that was the nature of that one of those documentaries was kind of, you know, in regards to, like, the youth outreach that Israel was doing. But I still wonder, like, where does that relationship come from, that American love affair with Israel? And, like, I know, like, the whole Zionism idea, like, the promised land with Jerusalem for Christians and Muslims, you know, and Jews. And I understand that part, but it still doesn't make sense to me why America is so pro-Israel. Is it just strategically? Because it's like there's so many other countries there that are Muslim, and they don't want a Muslim stronghold in the Middle East.
That's a big part of it that doesn't usually get articulated, because it doesn't endear to pathos the same way that, you know, some of the other propaganda does.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's, like, a huge part of it is that Israel's existence is a really expedient for our military adventurism in the region. It's just sort of like a U.S. outpost.
Yeah.
I wrote down a quote from... Alexander Haig, who is a retired Army general and Secretary of State, who called Israel the largest U.S. aircraft carrier in the world.
Oh, shit. This is starting to make sense to me now. Because I remember reading about it once, and it's just been years since I read about it, and I was just too, I don't know, just not emotionally available enough to, like, take on any more information about conflicts in the world. I'm glad, you know, I'm glad you guys are here to kind of remind me and kind of illustrate the new the developments for me. But yeah, it just sounds like some fucking bullshit. I'm pissed. I'm pissed now. Like, now I'm all mad. This is why I didn't want to know about this stuff, because now I'm all pissed.
Yeah, it takes a toll. I've been pouring through it really heavy the past week, and I definitely hit a wall at some point where it was like, how much more do you need to know? Like, the answer is so clear, but, like, how you actually do anything about it is very unclear.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys know Gabor Maté.
No.
Gabor Maté, I've heard of this.
He's, like, he's a famous speaker, kind of philosopher, and also a Jew who was, like, a Holocaust survivor. He was a baby during the Holocaust. And so, you know, someone with a pertinent opinion on it, you know, someone who, you might want to know how they feel about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically the idea with Israel is that it was, you know, a gift to the Jews after World War II, after all of the terrible genocide they went through.
Yeah.
Right.
From World War II, and at a way to kind of, like, give them some kind of penance or some kind of consolation prize.
Yeah.
The idea was that, oh, this is a land unoccupied.
Yeah.
An open, free land that just happens to be here. We'll just let you have this.
Who did that? Whose authority was that? Was that America?
The UN.
Oh, UN.
It was like a collective sort of. I'm pretty sure it was like one of those UN agreements.
It was everyone on the winning side of World War II.
Whoops.
And the odd thing about that is that it was a good faith attempt to address a very legitimate atrocity, which was perpetuated by Europe.
Yeah.
But it wasn't European land that was reallocated to give Jews a homeland. It was It was brown people's land.
Yeah, that's so fucked up.
There was a slogan. It was a land without a people for a people without a land.
Oh my God.
But the Palestinians were there.
Yeah.
There, like, there were millions of people. Were like, yeah.
Without a people. What are you talking about?
So they were ordered out, you know, at gunpoint by the military.
Jesus.
Some Christ. Of the same soldiers that were protected by Palestinians.
Yeah, when the British protectorate was rooting them out.
Yeah, it was the British.
They fed them and hid them. And then literally a year later launched a massive depopulation campaign in those cities to basically push everybody out of their homes at gunpoint.
Depopulation. That's a weird...
Yeah.
That's a fucked up word.
And they killed everyone who wouldn't leave their house. And there's pictures of it.
Which is weird that, like, some of the most vehement supporters of Israel are, like, sort of right-wing conservatives with a real prepossession with the Second Amendment, which is all premised on the idea of, like, standing your ground.
Yeah.
But you don't have an issue with...
private property. Yeah.
The way the language is twisted is always about, like, Palestinian violence and aggression, which exclusively exists in response to people coming into your home and, you know, pushing you out.
Right.
But they don't bat an eyelash at the idea that someone has a right to stand their ground and protect their ancestral homeland.
Yeah.
In fact, like, the line you hear more than anything is Israel has a right to defend itself, which, I mean, I always heard that.
Yeah.
Which sounds fine, but then you really dig into it and it's like, defend itself from what?
Yeah.
From people throwing rocks at the border wall that was erected through their...
Yeah. It sounds like they were too cowardly. The Allies, after the end of World War II, were too cowardly to set up a land for the Israelis on European soil. They thought, well, let's take the easy way out, right? It's also a plus one for colonial expansion, having a presence in the Middle East.
Right.
And now we're paying the fucking price for it. This is the same fucking bullshit that's going on in America. And we're trying to solve these issues that have a root so much deeper with, like, these, like, superficial solutions.
Mm.
But you have to get to the root of it. Otherwise, it's going to keep growing back like a, you know, a really bad weed, right? You know, you keep cutting off the top and then it keeps growing back because we never actually got to the root of the problem, which is that, like, we really shouldn't be here. In the first place.
I thought you liked bad weed, Oliver. I thought you liked mids.
To finish that thought earlier with Gabor Mate, he talked about how when he grew up, the dream of a free Israel, like a land for the Jews, was like a beautiful idea for him after all that he went through. Because even before World War II, like, Jews have a long history of being persecuted. You can't deny the beauty and the idea of it, but they just were misinformed. They were lied to. Like, it wasn't a land without a people.
Yeah.
And as he discovered the truth behind that, like, his opinion changed. You know, like, it kind of broke his heart in a lot of ways, and he kind of broke from the group. But like I said, like, 90% of people in Israel agree with the most egregious murders that happened. It's a very insular upbringing. If you're raised as a Jew, you're automatically raised, like, kind of like in America, like, you just sort of this American exceptionalism that we're all taught.
Uh-huh.
And so are the Jews. There's this kind of, like, the Jews in Israel, there's kind of this, like a love story.
They're the chosen.
After World War II and all their persecution, it's like a romanticized idea for them.
Yeah.
They're one shot at finding peace as a people. But that isn't true. Like, Gaza is just a 25-mile long strip along the ocean, 5 miles in.
Mm-hmm. With 2 million people living in it. It's like one of the most densely populated places in the world.
And like Dan was saying, like, they super disproportionately retaliate after, like, a Palestinian throws a rock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some, you know, super sophisticated Lockheed Martin rockets, which destroy a building. And because they control supply, they can't rebuild. The trucks, you know, and the supplies to sweep away the rubble and rebuild are not allowed into Palestine.
They don't allow any construction equipment through the border, and something like 94% of the fresh water in Gaza is toxic.
Fuck.
So they rely on water desalination plants because of their coastline for drinkable water. But then those were bombed also, and the materials needed to rebuild them are not allowed in.
Oh, no.
They bomb, like, routes to hospitals and a bunch of very shady stuff, you know, like, they have pinpoint accuracy, and so they don't ever claim, like, they've misfired. They just say, like, oh, Hamas was over there. Mm-hmm. They'll just use Hamas as an excuse to blow up anything.
Mm-hmm. Right. You hear Hamas all the time. It's not necessarily, like, an organized, unified body or constituency. Hamas is kind of the Antifa of Palestine. Mm-hmm. It's like, to what degree does it actually exist as an organized faction? It's all a reaction to aggression, but it's used very effectively as a straw man, a boogeyman.
Yeah.
You can say, like, what, they bombed the Al Jazeera?
The reporting.
Right, right. But they were like, there's Hamas... they're keeping Hamas rockets in the break room or some shit like that.
Wow. So many war crimes.
I try to, as much as I can, listen to discourse from diaspora Jews on the subject. Because the reality is, the support for Israel as an ethno-state, that project, is not, or so frequently, from Jews throughout the world. Like, the most aggressively supportive contingent is evangelical Christians.
Yeah.
We've had a little bit of exposure to that. I mean, I grew up evangelical Christian. I was brought up to stan the Jews as God's chosen people. For evangelical Christians, they're sort of like weebs for Judaism.
That's such a good comparison.
Yeah, it really is, right? I mean, I was raised to love the Jewish people.
Yeah, spot on, man.
And I've always had a lot of respect for their culture and, you know, for their cause.
Yeah.
But it's weird, like, the more I'm exposed to, I realize it's kind of an Orientalism, you know? Evangelical Christians project this significance and sovereignty onto them because of weird Christian eschatological prophecy about how they play an instrumental role in the end of the world and in, you know, the second coming of Christ and the apocalypse and all of them getting to heaven, with the caveat that the Jews don't actually get to heaven. They're just sort of a stepping stone for Christians to...
What?
It's very weird stuff. I mean, I've been sort of like doing a little refresher course on all of that stuff that I like sort of heard as a kid and... You know, it was just like, okay, that sounds cool. Uh-huh. But yeah, it's all about like the third temple has to be built.
Oh, right.
The Temple on the Mount.
The Holy of Holies?
Right, right. I mean, it depends on what denomination or faction of Christianity you're in, but like then the Antichrist shows up and brokers a peace, and then, you know, that ushers in some real Book of Revelation shit.
Yeah,
it's weird stuff. Hmm.
Where is this third temple supposed to be built?
In Jerusalem.
Where the Dome of the Rock is now.
What? Where is that?
The Dome of the Rock. It's like the third holiest site in Islam, second to Mecca and Medina. Yeah, and it's been there for a little while. So to demolish it, it would cause pretty significant outrage. But yeah, the whole premise is that until that's demolished and a Jewish temple is built in its place.
What?
I mean, that's what this evangelical prophecy, Jewish prophecy sort of co-opted and reinterpreted by Christianity portends.
Why do they have to destroy the previous, like, from their point of view, the logic behind?
I don't know. But that's why you hear that it's like different groups fighting over the same Holy Land.
I know, like, a lot of Christians go and visit the Holy Land too and do the walk.
Yeah, I remember people in church talking about, oh, I can't wait to go visit Israel. And
yeah. I remember my grandpa did that, actually. He went to Israel. It's interesting because they use the term Israel in the Bible, you know, for that place. But for a long time, the name, that country as it was, you know, known as Israel, it wasn't the case. Like, that wasn't the name for a long time.
Oh.
And it readopted the name Israel in 1940.
What?
Like the 40s.
Shit.
Yeah.
What was it before?
The ancient Egyptians called the area Peleset like 3,000 years ago. Assyrians called it Palashtu. And this is all pre-Roman.
Yeah, but even post-Roman, I'm pretty sure the name Israel changed among Jews as well. Like, it wasn't... That's a more recent thing. Like, for at least 1,000 years or so, it was another country.
Okay.
As the Christians, we grew up thinking, like, it's just been this place here. Like, God's kind of put, you know, for a special purpose, for a special prophecy purposes in the future.
Right.
And it kind of gives the wrong idea that, like, this Israel has been kind of a central part of the story still.
Yeah, it's a real manifest destiny analog. And then the defense that people use, like, if you take a birthright trip to Israel, they'll tell you, well, this land is yours because, you know, if you dig into this cave here, we find, like, a coin that was, we find, like, relics of a Jewish presence here 2,000 years ago. But you could do that, like, literally with any region of the world. I mean, that land has been populated by so many different people groups over time. Like, if I, as a Italian ex person, went to the UK, I could find my ancestors, you know, Roman artifacts that predate an Anglo-Saxon presence there. But, you know, to take the step that means I should be able to walk into anyone's home with a gun and say, this land is mine, this home is mine, and you got to get out of here, hey. Is ridiculous.
Hey, I'm walking here.
Hey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure would be a shame if someone took this beautiful home.
Shit. I wonder, so why, what so makes them so impassioned about doing this? I guess it's because they don't have anywhere else to go, right?
Who, the Israelis?
The Jews, yeah. Jews. They don't have anywhere else that was allotted to them. So who's the real fucking culprit here is the UN.
Well, now it's like an intersection of religion and politics, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's like, to leave would have religious and political implications that the Jews, like, aren't ready to handle.
Well, where would they even go? So they can't just tell them to leave. You can't just say, like, no, go away to either of them without giving them somewhere to fucking go.
Two-state solution.
They probably had a solution like that at some point, right? Didn't they have, like, a, oh, actually, Palestinians, you guys can go here. And they were like, fuck that, right? Isn't that what happened?
There were borders drawn that were, like, Palestinian had lost ground. Mm-hmm. It's like Israel has been encroaching on their land over the 60 mm-hmm. years. Okay. So I'm pretty sure one of the agreements is like just to go back to that original border drawing delineation of the agreement they came up mm-hmm. with
right
many years ago.
Mm-hmm. Jews and Christians and Muslims all coexisted in that land for a long time, relatively peacefully. The issue is the idea that it should exist exclusively as a Jewish ethnostate, you know. Mm-hmm. That's where it starts to get into ethnic cleansing and genocidal territory. Mm-hmm. That's where it starts to get into, you know, the Jews can do a little Holocaust as a treat.
That's such a good meme you made, by the way.
That was a meme?
It was a tweet that got me banned from Twitter for 24 hours or something.
Oh, right. They got you banned.
Nice. You said mm-hmm. that the Jews could do...
That's crazy.
...a little Holocaust.
That's like a meme.
As a treat. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sad because it's really like, you know, like on like a personal... like individualized level, they talk about the perpetuation of a cycle of abuse, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. That's what I was going to say earlier.
You experience trauma and abuse.
I was going to say that at the very beginning of this conversation, but I didn't want to appear ignorant or bigoted. So I'm glad it came out.
You be as ignorant
like,
as you want.
I'm ignorant of this situation, but from the very beginning, what it sounds like is from what's going on from the Jewish perspective is, they got fucked over and they're still hurting from it. And so they're, you know, perpetuating that hate onto the next group of people. And it's like that's just a common mm-hmm. psychological mm-hmm. phenomenon you see in like relationships. And like, you know, every time you see, it's like a natural human tendency. You can almost predict it like clockwork. And you become without steady and doing the work to rehabilitate and heal yourself. You can all easily accidentally become very similar to your abuser.
Become what you always hated.
Fairness is like a tool of the propagandists. They try to make you believe like, oh, in order for this to be fair, you need to do the same thing. And that's not, we don't live in a fair, just world in that way, where we get to execute our own interpretation, our will of what should be fair based on the atrocities that happened to us in the past.
Sure. An eye for an eye and the whole world's blind.
Yeah.
It's very sad, you know, it's very tragic when you think about it.
Yeah.
And ironic, too.
You have to wonder, like, are we doing ourselves and them a disservice by not holding them accountable for some of the pain that they're going back and lashing out and inflicting onto this world?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's white guilt. If you're paralyzed by white guilt, you're going to allow things like that to occur.
I feel like it's kind of a complicated thing, I would say. Like, I feel mm-hmm. like, you know, there's a difference between anti-Semitism in America and, you know, in Western countries mm-hmm. and the Israel-Palestine conflict, which often use claims of, oh, no, don't be anti-Semitic mm-hmm. as cover for their atrocities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Often when there is dissent expressed in the United States against policies of the Israeli government, people here are called anti-Semitic. What is your response to that as an Israeli Jew?
Well, it's a trick. We always use it. When from Europe somebody is criticizing Israel, then we bring up the Holocaust. When in this country people are criticizing Israel, then they are anti-Semitic.
But at the same time, I think anti-Semitism in America is more of a real cause to be concerned with. I remember, because I grew up a Christian, too, so, like, the Jews were sort of, like, the special ones, mm-hmm. you know, these kind of, like, dance at the weeps. So I grew up with a weird kind of fetishization of Jewish people. And I remember being surprised to learn that of anti-Semitism, like, I mean, I knew of the Holocaust, obviously, but I kind of thought that was old news now. I thought maybe we were, you know, anti-Semitism was fixed or solved or whatever. But I know lots of claims of anti-Semitism are still used in today's, you know, like identity politics. Mm-hmm. That comes up a lot, obviously. And there's lots of kind of kooky theories out there, I would say, regarding, like, you know, the Jews controlling all the media and all that kind of stuff. The Jews will not replace us in the kind of New World Order, which is more of an American and, like, Western phenomenon, not so much a Palestinian-Israel thing.
It's not related.
And I think those are two different things.
Yes. Yeah.
It's not related in any way.
I mean, you could trace everything back to a, you know, maybe a common origin, but it's a pretty significantly different relationship. And people in the U.S. are starting to, I mean, it starts to become undeniable, especially like after last summer, you know, when you saw police just like savagely beating down on people for peacefully protesting during the race riots, as I like to call them, or whatever we're officially calling it now. But to see that here and then to see the same thing happen, you know, to see IDF soldiers like beating the shit out of families and lynching people in the street. And it's pretty hard to make the same old arguments for an American, American audience in American media. But over the past couple of years, the lobbyists that advance Israel's interests have tried different techniques. There was like a whole pinkwashing thing where they tried to say like Israel is a LGBT paradise, which didn't really work. I remember getting like ads for Birthright that were like gay themed because my Instagram algorithm thinks I'm gay and Jewish for some reason.
That's funny.
But now that's kind of fallen by the wayside. And as this graphic imagery starts coming out of the conflict and people's minds are starting to change, there has been an attempt to kind of muddy the waters with a conversation about anti-Semitism, which is, I mean, anti-Semitism is a real thing. You know, hate exists, and it's always existed in that form in the U.S., but the goalposts for what anti-Semitism is keep moving. Like, I heard a figure that anti-Semitic hate crimes in the U.S. over the past several weeks have increased, like a 200 gajillion percent or something like that. But then you start to look into it, like, what are these reports? And it's like, you know, someone had a Free Palestine sign, or someone saw graffiti that said Free Palestine on a Dunkin' Donuts. And these are all, you know, these are all submitted by the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, without any evidence or real scrutiny or inquiry into their validity, which, I mean, the ADL, which is a group that protected Jewish interests in the U.S. and by their own definition fought anti-Semitism in the U.S., their official definition of anti-Semitism is any denial that Israel deserves to exist as an ethno-state. So, you know, if you advocate for a one-state solution with equal rights between all people in the region, denying the Jewish character of Israel, that by definition is anti-Semitism. This is the whole thing, is the conflation of anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism.
And it's very easy to blame people who criticize certain acts of the Israeli government as anti-Semitic, and to bring up the Holocaust and the suffering of the Jewish people, and that justify everything we do to the Palestinians.
What's it like over there? I don't know. Like, or is it a totally different population with totally different values than the people you find here in America?
Public opinion is still is different. Yeah, I mean, I've seen some like more, you know, Jews of notoriety, like famous Jews, you know, kind of coming out and speaking out against Israel's occupation of Palestine in America. But that's still really rare in Israel.
Yeah, Bernie was one of them. And as we all learned, Bernie is anti-Semitic.
Oh, now he's anti-Semitic?
Yes, and he's sexist. Wait,
oh, what? Yeah, there was a huge push to label Bernie Sanders as anti-Semitic from sort of the, you know, liberal left.
Crazy.
There's still a pretty strong liberal Zionist contingent in addition to, like, the, you know, conservative evangelical Zionism that makes up most of that demographic.
Yeah. And I think, you know, most Jews here are more, you know, there's a range of Orthodox to casual Jews. And I think if you're in Israel growing up in that culture, the religious side is going to be more indoctrinated, I think, among the people. And it's going to be more of a singular group think. Because that's what it seems like with the data, with the stats.
Sure.
At some point, they were able to legally label all of Palestine as Hamas and claim it was all, like, you know, a terrorist organization, which only led them to, like, more rampage and more destruction of Palestine, more rockets,
right,
and all that kind of stuff. They don't have Iron Dome protecting them. I think the craziest thing is, like, Palestinians can't leave Palestine. I don't think people understand that. To leave, you could maybe claim a health permit sometimes, like if you're injured and you need, like, help from a hospital in resources that aren't available within the Gaza Strip. But those permits are, like, very, very temporary and less frequently given out. So unless you have one of these injury permits, you can't leave. Like, it's an open-air prison.
Whoa. Yeah, you can't get medical care unless you are granted a hall pass to leave. You can't pursue an education unless you are, you know, given a special permit to go to school outside of the borders of...
Shit.
So, you know, it's... I mean, anyone living in this place doesn't really have a future.
Yeah.
You're sort of... you're disconnected from your past, and you don't have a future. I think something like 80% of the people living in Gaza are refugees from other parts of Palestine that are now colonized by Israel within the last 10 or 20 years.
Yikes. So it sounds like, so we have different types of practicing Jews or non-practicing Jews in America, right?
Yeah, but in Israel too, there's Orthodox Jews, there's practicing, there's secular Jews in Israel.
But they're so disconnected from the whole country. I feel like the Jews here in America are so disconnected from them. They're just told as young, like, oh, we support Israel in that conflict. Don't ask too many questions. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly, right. Exactly.
And they just
There are major campaigns, propaganda campaigns, to reintegrate them into the project of a Jewish homeland in Israel. There's, like, birthright.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I had a friend who had to go over there and fight.
It's compulsory military service. You have to.
In 2 years, right?
2 years.
Oh, yeah. Okay. It's all starting to come back to me now.
Which is weird, because then I wrestle with the idea of, to what degree could you say that Israelis are complicit in what the country and the government of Israel is doing? You know, the military service is compulsory.
Right.
But, of course, that doesn't mean that you have to do it. Like, there was a Taylor Swift fan account on Twitter that posted something about, sorry, guys, I'm going to be not posting for a while because I'm being sent to jail. People were like, why? And they were like, because I live in Israel and I refused to serve in the IDF.
Oh, yeah, I heard about
this. Yeah, I've seen reports of, like, people boycotting the IDF and joining it, like, younger people like that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, there's definitely a massive cultural push to bring the Jewish diaspora from all over the world, especially the United States,
back to Israel to fight.
Or at least to, you know, be propagandized and endeared to Israel as a Jewish homeland. You know that Cars for Kids? It's like a nonprofit with a really, really annoying commercial.
1-877 Cars for Kids.
Yeah.
Have you seen Cars for Kids with a K?
It's Cars with a K.
It's a kid's computer. It's the sequel to the kid's computer.
Computer.
Sorry. What were you going to say, Dan?
Yeah, Cars for Kids is a charity where you're supposed to donate your car for a tax write-off or whatever. But it's actually a Zionist organization, and the money goes to bringing young Americans to Israel so that they can go, look at this place. This is yours.
Uh-huh.
And don't worry about those Palestinians over there. Don't look over there. Mm-hmm. And Birthright. I mean, Birthright's the biggest one. That's the most well-known. It's like Zionist summer camp. And the whole idea is you, like a teenager from the U.S. gets a free trip to Israel. And they bring all the, like, hottest IDF soldiers to lead the tour group. And then you're kind of supposed to, like, fall in love and let an IDF soldier nut inside of you so you can perpetuate the next generation of, like, Zionist Jews.
Holy shit.
And be connected to Israel as a homeland.
Yeah, the ethno-state implications of that are really gross.
Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not necessarily opposed to the Jewish project of having a homeland.
Mm-hmm.
But the aggressive pursuit of that homeland existing as an ethno-state, you know, at the expense of the inhabitants of that land.
Yeah, it's almost hypocritical. I was going to say, what's their reasoning, you know, for doing that, this ethnic cleansing? But there's not a reasoning involved beyond the pain, like the suffering reenacting the cycle. There's obviously, you can rationalize anything, But it sounds like that and, you know, who are we to say, as Americans, who are we to say, no, you can't do that? And, like, literally, we're just being hypocrites. Like, we're literally standing on this land right now saying that.
Right, right. That's a line that I hear a lot, too, is like, oh, well, if you're so critical of Israel, America is ancestral land. Your presence here is the result of settler colonialism. Should America be given back to its original inhabitants? And, like, yes, obviously, of course. I think, yeah, the Native Americans would definitely make better stewards of the land than the U.S. as it exists now has. But because it was such a long time ago, the degree to which that land could be reallocated at a realistic scale is... I mean, to what degree those Native people still exist at a scale that this land could be returned to them, how much those people are owed. Obviously, the reparations given to them are insufficient. But if you can stand by and watch displacement and colonialism happening right now in Israel, actively happening before your eyes, that begs the question that if you were around during the birth of this nation, would you just stand by and allow it to happen the way it did? I mean, Oliver, you've spent more time directly with Native Americans or... Well, what is it you told us? It's like they told you that... Now they're trying to change it to Native Americans or American Indians, another term that they keep changing. But the tribes that you've spent time with have been like, you guys called us Indians.
Yeah.
And you did that for hundreds of years. So you can't just change it now because you're trying to.
Yeah. So we're not going to let you just
sanitize it and be woke.
Yeah. You can't have that. No, we don't forgive you. Like, fuck off.
Right.
And that's a common misconception that is, I think, propaganda. Like one of the most heavily propagandized falsehoods about Native Americans is that they're dying people. But like when we first got here, when Columbus got here, there's between 7 million and 18 million Native Americans here. And at this current day, there's 5 million Native Americans here. So really, they're just shoved off into these little corners. All the land, all the good land has been taken up by white people, by the cities, the national parks are, you know, mainly the cities are sitting on this like perfectly fertile, like the land where the rivers run through it, and it's not too hot and not too cold, and the Native Americans have been pushed off into the corners. And so yeah, they're suffering, but they're fucking strong and they're surviving in that. I feel like it'd be just as feasible for us to withdraw, not all of our population, like, but white people to withdraw maybe half or more of their population, like slowly back to Europe, who is suffering from a population decline crisis. I don't know much about the what the Palestinian infrastructure is like, but there's 5 million Native Americans in the United States right now. It could be argued, if I had to just guess off the cuff, that they might have an even better chance of repopulating the land in a healthy way than what's left of the Palestinians after all this ethnic cleansing. They both deserve their land back. And in the same way that it's possible for Israelis to withdraw from the territories that they're just trying to take over. And we have to set an example. Like, that's part of asking the Israelis to stop being such dickheads, is to just do the same thing ourselves.
But I'm curious, like, Oliver, having spent time, what would they like to see?
We'll joke about it. But we haven't talked about white people leaving because they're being very accepting of me. They're not going to say anything that's going to make me feel like shit.
Sure.
They're not even going to say something as mean as, You'll never be Lakota. You're white. You can't actually be this. You can't actually be that. They're so incredibly accepting. I've been like very like graciously, warmly accepted, so far more than I thought I would be. You know, as a white person coming in, I thought I was going to be stepping on people's toes and offending people left and right. Turns out a lot of the things that I thought I would offend people with weren't really offensive at all. And a lot of things that I thought wouldn't be offensive at all, like talking too much, were incredibly offensive, you know, or asking too many questions or something like that. Like, it's pretty easy to not be offensive. You just don't talk too much and do a lot of listening. That's kind of the way it is with everybody, right? But yeah, that's the takeaway, that the main takeaway that I get that was the most surprising to me was resilience. Who's on the reservations to this day? Yeah, there's a significant portion of the population that suffers from addiction, alcoholism, despair, from the traumas that occurred, and the lack of proper infrastructure that's there to support them. Mm-hmm. But they're just a tremendous amount of resilience. When you look at like the sheer strength, like the mental fortitude of somebody who could grow up on a res and come out with like their sobriety and their life and their motivation and their hope is something that we didn't experience growing up. We'll never get to be as strong as someone like that, unfortunately. Like, I can go to the sweat lodge once a week for 5 years. Because of the way I was raised, I most likely won't ever be as strong, like might have the same mental fortitude as somebody who grew up on the res and can just like...
Yeah.
Like, everything is a blessing. Everything is appreciated. And that's why I think that they're gonna ultimately outlast us. If you think about like what Jesus said, or just a common saying, the meek shall inherit the earth.
Mm-hmm.
People who have gone through hardship are gonna be the ultimate winners in this battle, this war that's occurring for resources and redistribution of wealth. Like, a rich person wouldn't last a day without their luxuries. A poor person could last pretty fucking long, you know? And so as soon as those luxuries start to get taken away, the poor people will start to take the power back.